Morning.
Morning.
And Happy New Year. Yeah. And to you too. Good. Well, after what Rob has just been saying, I think I've just changed my sermon completely. However, I better stick to it. It was about resolutions, eh? Yeah. Who can say Happy New Year in another language? Gong hei fa choy. Okay. Sun ya kwai lok. Okay, that's Malay, right? Anyone else? Okay. Sini and Kuai Le in China. Oh, Vincent? Oh, is it Bon Bon Anne? Yeah, Bon Anne, Bénéficion, I think, in French. Yeah. And in German? Ein glückliches neues Jahr. And what is Horoshi Novi God? Russian. That's Russian. And my attempt at Russian. Not very good at Russian. However, we're going to first slide. So what we're going to talk about is, as I always start, or so often start, is the words. Are we having a resolution or a revolution this year? So we are all about, Robert, we're all about making resolutions. We are about making resolutions. It's a great opportunity, and we make a resolution. Now, the word resolution originally comes from, of course, it's related to the word a resolve or solution, but it's release or unleash. So it means to unleash or give a new idea or new way of proceeding, and it's to unleash your potential. Is to unleash or release your potential. So one of the things about making a New Year's resolution is to do something that releases or unleashes your potential and our church's potential for 2017. And so today is a really important day for considering what is our potential for 2017. What is it that we can unleash in 2017, so that on the 31st of December 2017, we can look back and say we sort of achieved maybe that potential that we identified at this time. Now, when you look at the word revolution, that actually is a very interesting word. It's like revolve. And again, re means back, but it means turn the eyes back. So a revolution actually is looking back, not forward. And what revolution does is look back to see what it is that needs to be changed, to change all of that, and to go forward doing something new, and to start again with a whole new way of doing things. So it's to look back, assess, and drop, change, and forget the things or learn from, and then do new things. So that's a revolution. And as an aside, I was just reading recently that this year is the 100th anniversary or centenary of something that happened in 1917. And having just quoted the language thereof, Russian Revolution. And the Russians are wondering how on earth they're going to celebrate Lenin in 2017. Because, of course, they're now post-communist. But it's such an important event in Russian history that they can't ignore it. So how do you celebrate 1917 in Russia? Won't worry about that question right now. What the text gives us is a revolution in the lives of the Israelite people. After 460 years, they're actually moving out of Egypt. This is a whole new step. This is something new for them, and they're going out, leaving into the unknown. They're doing something that's completely different. That's not like the 459th year when they're still in Egypt, working out how to cope with another year under Egyptian rule. The 460th year, and now God has said it's time. It's time to go and do something new and to step out in faith and to step out literally into the desert where they don't know where they're going. This year is also, just parallel to this, some important anniversaries here in this church. Do we know what they are? This church has two important anniversaries this year, and I think this passage impinges on what this these anniversaries. The first is the 60th anniversary of this building. In June 1957, this building was opened by the moderator of the General Assembly, and today we have this building in which we can worship. We may be thinking of some of the inadequacies and deficiencies of the building for ministry today, but we should be grateful, and we start this year grateful and full of gratitude for what was accomplished 60 years ago in June when they opened this building so that we can be here today. It's also the 120th anniversary of something. The Presbytery of Auckland in 1892 decided that they would start a mission to Chinese people in Auckland. That was the very first decision that the church made, that it was important to reach out to Chinese people. And that was in December 1892, when they, in good Presbyterian fashion, set up a committee to look at the issue of ministering to Chinese people. And 1893 is also an important year. That's when the first missioner arrived, but we'll worry about that next year. But this is an important anniversary, because that was the day in December 1892 when they decided it was important to reach out to Chinese people, and the whole mission that's led to us today has begun. So as we look at this passage, I'd just like to keep that a little bit in mind, those two important anniversaries in our own history, because what the Egyptians and the Israelites go through is very important for us. Now in verse 17, I just want to make a brief point about this, that God led them out, but he didn't take them to the shortest way to the promised land. If you look in verse 17, he's quite clear, he's not taking them the shortest way to the promised land. He takes them a long way round. In other words, it has taken 60 years and 125 years to get here. It took a fair while for them to get to where they were going. They could have got there in quite a short little burst if they'd just gone straight up the coast. Why didn't they? And the reason is also clear, if you know the background, that those were along the coast were where the Egyptians had all their strongest military posts, outposts. It was also the land of the Philistines. Who knows who Philistines are? Or what does the word Philistine in English mean today? It's still used, at least some of the older generation, I think, would know about Philistines. Philistines are people who are a wee bit overbearing, arrogant, and demanding. And the Philistines were the enemies of the Israelite people. So in this passage, what you've got are two forces against the Israelite people lined along the shortest route between where they're going and where they want to go. And so God takes them around the longer route to get where they to go. But there's also says there that they're ready for battle, but they're not ready for this battle. They're not ready to fight both those at once. They are ready for battle, that's clear in the next verse, but they're not ready to take on such a big battle just yet. And so what God does is take the Israelites out of their comfort zone. He pushes them out of Egypt, but he doesn't overwhelm them and then send them back but defeated. He takes them out of their comfort zone. He gives them a challenge, but the challenge is not so great that they can't cope and that they're going to be defeated. It's actually bad enough going around the other way, which is around what is today the Gulf of Suez. And it is a battle and a difficult time for them there. But at least we can say that God does not overwhelm them. He takes them out of their comfort zone, but he doesn't give them too big a challenge, too hard a task, and so that they're defeated. And so I think, again, that's similar to us today. We need to be taken out of our comfort zone, that's for sure. There are 100,000 people out there in Auckland City every day. That's too much. And so we have to start somewhere. And so over the last year, we've been looking just at this corner of the inner city and the ways in which we can minister to people here in Vincent Street and just some of the surrounding streets. And we can look at more as time goes on. But the important thing here in the passage is that God guides the people and shows them that they won't be overwhelmed. He strengthens them through two particular ways. And there's two little interesting points here that we need just to remember as we look at this passage. As we look at the passage, there's rather a gruesome bit of information here that they've actually picked up the bones of Joseph and hauled them off with them through to the promised land. Now, they've got the bones of Joseph, and if you look at Genesis chapter 50, 25 and 26, Joseph was placed his body when he died in a tomb, but the tomb was above the ground. It wasn't buried, right? And the reason for that was they never intended to stay in Egypt. So he died in Egypt, but the tomb was above the ground, not under the ground. So he wasn't buried in the ground. He was put in a tomb, which was actually above the ground. And the reason for that is that they intended, when the time came, to take his bones to the promised land, because he was the leader who heard God promise that God would give them this promised land, that they would be one day taken there. They would one day be guided to this new land and taken out of slavery. So the bones of Joseph represent that promise. And now the promise is being fulfilled. And by taking the bones with them, taking his body with them, that's a visible sign, a visible witness that God has promised. 460 years earlier, sure, but God has promised that he will be with them and he will guide them to the promised land. So as the bones got, I don't know how they carried them, they're probably in a box of some sort, but as they went along, they would have got a bit depressed, a bit thirsty, a bit hungry, a bit hot. And it would be by looking at that casket that they would gain encouragement and they'd gain assurance or reassurance that they were doing the right thing. God had promised. It was a revolution. They were looking back to see what God had promised 460 years ago, and they were looking forward to where that promise was leading them and where that promise would take them. And I think the other word to use there is it's an insurance that God has insured that they will succeed. That no matter what the hardships, God has insured them that they will succeed and get to where they're growing. So, and the second thing is, he's got Joseph's bones there with him. The second thing is that God is in front of them. So the promise is right with them, but God is in front of them. And he's in front of them in two ways. How is he in front of them? Who's awake still? Who can tell me? How is he in front of them? The cloud and the fire. So there's two things, there's two images. One is the cloud and one is the fire. And the cloud and fire are symbolic. God, we can well imagine there was actually a cloud and actually a fire, but there's also a symbolic value to these terms. And the cloud is protection. Because remember where they are, they're in the desert. And the cloud is protecting them from the hot sun. And so the cloud leads them forward, they're under the cloud. Under the cloud in English is a bit of a negative word. It's actually very positive for them because they're being protected, they're being guided through by this cloud and from the heat. But the fire, what does fire do? That gives you light, it gives you in the dark, it gives you warmth in the dark, and gives you it gives you direction when you need it. And so we can say that God is present in both ways. He protects, or in a number of ways. He protects us, he leads us, he gives us warmth, he gives us light, he gives us direction. And so in this passage, we can see God directing and guiding the people forward as they move. But they have to be moving, because the cloud, and it's quite clear, the cloud and the fire are moving. If the people stay still, then the cloud and fire may well keep going. And so part of the revolution and the resolution is to keep moving, to keep going. Otherwise, it gets out of sight and the cloud moves on and we're burnt up and we lose direction in the heat. So the cloud and the fire give them assurance, they give them protection, they give them light, they give them direction, but they also has taken them out of their comfort zone and also encourage them to keep moving and to keep going forward. So can we have the next slide? Just going back to the mission there before. What is, as we go forward in mission here, what did they actually, we look back now, to 1892, the mission was designed to be educational, philanthropic, and religious. What do you think of that phrase? That's what the presbytery, in all their wisdom, in 1892 decided. It's to be educational, philanthropic, and religious. The word religion had a much more positive meaning in those days, to start at that end. So it was to be Christian, it was to be gospel-bringing, it was to be light-giving. Philanthropic, what does philanthropic mean? Giving. It was to give to the Chinese people in Auckland, to give them, to assess what they need and to supply those needs. Educational? Teach. And basically, teach English and teach the ways of the local society. That's actually revolutionary in 1892. Right? Because in 1892, nobody actually wanted the Chinese in Auckland. Right? And there is, and it's a well-known fact that at this time, I haven't got them here, but I think it's something like there were 2,344 Chinese men in Auckland, in New Zealand, and 24 women. Right. Why were there only 24 women? It was government policy. And the problem was, if you have 2,444 women and 2,440 men, what are they going to do? Yeah. They're going to marry. And what's going to happen? They're going to have children, and so the Chinese population will grow. And so at that time, there was a fear of Chinese folk. And the presbytery, to their credit, decided that that was not the Christian way of looking at this matter, and they set up the mission. Okay, next one. Right, words of the year. What is the word of the year according to the Oxford Dictionary? Post-truth. Come to that in a moment. What was last year's one? Emoji. What's an emoji? Imagery. Am I saying it right? I don't even know what it is. It's those things on Facebook. And these are words that have just come into the language, and there's an exponential explosion of the use of these words. Right? So, and last year it was emoji. So the year before, nobody's talking about it, or very few, and then all of a sudden it explodes, and everybody's talking about emojis, except me. Selfie. That was an early one. What's a selfie? Who doesn't know what a selfie is? Yeah. And before that, omni-shambles. It's an omni-shambles. Right. And those are words that the Oxford Dictionary, and, you know, this when you go to Oxford, you know, there's not a lot of they're pretty serious people there. So they take these, it's really quite something for them to identify these words and put them in their dictionary, I think. So what is post-truth? What is a post-truth? Could we have the next slide? Post-truth is debate. Debate is framed largely by appeals to emotion disconnected from the details of policy and by the repeated assertion of talking points to which factual rebuttals are rebuked. Are ignored. Right, so what does that mean? It means the facts don't matter. It means that facts don't matter. What matters is whether people feel that that is correct and they feel good and encouraged and assured by what's said. So it doesn't matter what whether it's factual or not. What matters is whether people relate to what you're saying and whether it is actually something that people can respond to. And a number of, we'll be here all day if I start press my button and we talk about Brexit and Donald Trump, right? But you'll be getting some of the impressions of what that could mean. Next one. We'll come to that in a moment. Yeah. Now, so the post-truth is, I think, one of the key points about post-truth and one of the challenges for us this year and one of the challenges for all of us as a Christian church is that truth matters. Facts matter. What is true matters, what is factual matters, and our interpretation of the facts needs to be based on education, insight, and research. So we need to know what we're talking about, and we need to insist on what is actually factual and is what is right. And I suspect one of the crises of this year will be the crises over fact and what is actually true. And what politicians and people say matters if it is true or not. And we need to be the ones to say, is that true? And is that factually correct? And is that the right interpretation of the facts that we have it before us? And here in the passage, I think we've got, in some ways, a view of ancient post-truth, right? And in verses 14.5, you get the Pharaoh, right? And he's lamenting that they let the people go. But if he gets why they let them go, or he doesn't tell us why they let them go, because they had all those plagues, right? And now he's focusing, we've lost our servants. And he's saying, why did we let them go? He's not actually talking about why they did let them go, which was based on very sound reasoning. Now he's saying, we shouldn't have let them go. Why did we let them go? There was no reason to let them go. Now we're going to go and get them again. And so he's now turned his mind away from the truth of what the actual reason for the decision was, and he's coming up with another question, was we shouldn't have let them go in the first place. And then you see the also where the verse 11, and I think this is another one, it goes back to the graves. Why were there no graves in Egypt? Did you leave us, and the people complain, you brought us into the desert, we had no graves. Because we had no graves, did you lead us in here into the desert to die? They forget the fact that Joseph had laid above the ground, not under the ground, and the reason for having no graves was precisely because God would take them into the desert and into the promised land. They're not reviewing, not thinking about, not remembering the reason why Joseph was not buried. They complain about the situation that they faced that particular time. And so as we go through this year, there will be difficult times, I'm sure, and there will be times where we're not quite sure what we're doing. But let's, if we look back, and as we think about what has happened, and let's think about what God has promised and how God has led us in the past, since and over the last 125 years and 60 years. And God is always bigger than the Egyptians. God is bigger than our challenges. So, just in conclusion, let's unleash the potential of ourselves and APC in this year. That's our resolution, to unleash the potential, to identify and unleash our potential. Let's think about how God has been with us personally over the last year, over the last 5 years, 15 years, 60 years and 125 years, and draw strength, insurance, assurance, confidence, encouragement from that. And most of all, perhaps, in verse 13 and 14, the phrase that God so often uses when we're venturing into something new, so often says when we're trying to do or accepting a new challenge, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. I am with you. Just as Joseph's bones were with the people of Israel, I am with you. Just as God was before them, I am leading you. So don't be afraid. I am with you. I am leading you. Stand firm. Remember what has happened in the past. Hold on to those facts that we know, those things that we know about God and are convinced of. And finally, be stilled. As we're saying with Silent Night last week, you know, stille Nacht means the night that has been stilled. It doesn't mean silent night. It means the night that has been stilled by God's grace, peace, and love. Everything that is against God has been stilled. Now we have a stilled heart, stilled mind, which we can rely on because he has given us that new peace and grace. So we can look forward not just to celebrating 60 years and 125 years. The celebration is a celebration, of course, of all of God's goodness and grace to us, our gratitude to him. But it's also an encouragement and a strength, a resource for going forward on our new revolution and resolution into this year and beyond. So just to conclude, this is, who's Gordon Ramsay? The chef. I don't like looking back, I'm always looking forward. I'm not the one to sort of sit and cry over spilt milk. I'm too busy looking for the next car. So don't cry over spilt milk. Whatever it was that happened in 2016 that you regret, don't cry over spilt milk. Look for the next car, the next opportunity. Next one. Looking back, my whole life seems so real. I didn't just turn up on the doorstep playing rugby. I had to go through a whole lot of things to get there. Who was Jonah Lomu? one of our greatest All Blacks. And that reminds us that we do go through a desert. There is a desert to go through in 2017, but the test match won't be easy, but nevertheless, it's almost surreal. It is above reality, but it is still real, God leading us. And last one. Looking back, I imagine I was always writing. Twaddle it was too, but far better write twaddle or anything, rather than nothing at all. Catherine Mansfield. Who's Catherine Mansfield? New Zealand's greatest, or probably greatest, writer. What do you think she means? Just do something. Probably if Nike's put it a lot shorter, what did Nike say? Just do it. Okay, so this year, having thought about it, just do it. Amen.